Well, we because of Easter, this one's been a little bit, just a little bit. There was a big break for Easter, so we talked the first one. We talked a lot about how there's the fear of man, there's the fear of circumstances, and then there's the fear of the Lord, and how the fear of the Lord really is the thing that drives out sinful fears or disordered fears. That was a lot of the first session. And then this past time we talked through about what does it mean to say that fear, though not always sinful, can be sinful, and that we should be willing to examine our anxieties and our worries, and how can we evaluate when those fears are actually causing us or bringing us into sin. Toward the end, I kind of foot-stomped on the idea of that I don't think we should focus on the sensations or the feelings of fear and try and fight at that level, but rather to fight at the level of thoughts, words, and actions. How do I actually make sure that fear, my feeling of fear, does not drive me to actions that are sinful as a result, and fight at that level, trusting that over time that's actually going to help with the feelings themselves. I think feelings do tend to follow actions. And so I think when we get into habits of doing what is right, then God will bless that with actually helping us cope more readily with the disordered sensations and the disordered feelings.
And it really causes you to be, it helps you to not be enslaved to fear if you do exactly what you just said. You know, doing, it's been said that courage is not the lack of fear. Courage is doing what is right, even when you're afraid.
Yes.
Right? And when you are afraid and you do what is right in that moment, that, number one, proves that you're not enslaved.
Yes.
Two, assists you to not be enslaved. And three, also in time, has a cumulative effect such that you will feel less afraid, mm-hmm. in fact. So I just wanted to footstop my significant agreement with you in regards to doing what is right when you're afraid.
Mm-hmm. Would you also go this far? Someone who significantly struggles with sinful feelings, if they are consistently doing what is right in response to that, would you say that, I would tend to say that person doesn't need to worry that they are enslaved to fear because the feelings persist.
Correct.
As long as they are actually doing what is right and obeying God in the midst of those fearful feelings.
I think so, just because our feelings are such weird and fickle things. So we can't always control them. They tend to be lagging our decisions and truth. And so I'm going to cling to truth, and I'm going to cling to the reality that truth is going to transform, and I'm going to do what's right. And if these feelings continue to persist, I'm not going to put over much focus on them and think, you know, what am I really doing wrong, right? I'm really in sin here. No, you're actually doing what is right. You can't always control your feelings.
Yeah, we can't. Well,
actually, you can't control your feelings. Not directly.
Not directly.
Not directly. Yeah.
So, but there's probably lots of questions. This is one that, because of our cultural moment and how anxiety is really normalized in our culture, I'm imagining there's just a lot of questions. So I have some, if you don't have any, but I sure hope you have some. Jacob?
Last week someone asked a question about medication and whatnot, and I thought you said you'd address that this week, or is that a following week?
It is. I was wondering if there was a specific question. So medication, yes, that's a good question. Is there anyone that would like to pose a particular question? Yeah, Julia?
I was just curious, because it feels to me like there are situations, like if someone finds out they have cancer and they have like a surgery coming up, it feels to me like there is a sense of fear that is natural in that situation that isn't necessarily sinful. Is that, like, is there a situation where someone can genuinely be like afraid of a certain outcome, but if they're able to trust God through that, like, if that's okay? Or is it always like, if you're afraid, then you need to like bring those feelings to God and ask him, like, I don't know, does that make sense? Is there a time and a place for fear that's not necessarily, like, instant, like you see a bear and you're afraid or whatever?
Meaning if someone is actually facing a rather dreadful series of circumstances, is it a problem for them to feel those feelings of fear and dreadful anticipation, say they're about to face a difficult surgery? BJ, you want to?
I guess my immediate pastoral sniff test would be, I don't think if you just come face-to-face with a cancer diagnosis, I don't think it's unreasonable at all to say that you'd have a response of fear. I mean, the psalmist says, when I am afraid, I put my trust in you. So it's fearful to think about facing your death in yea so much time. It's fearful to think about that reality. I think that's the, if you will, I think it's equivalent to seeing a bear, right? It's as equally weighty and sober. You're staring at death that is coming, that's just been told to you. The question is, what do you do with that? Is then the key question. Do you allow that to cause you to spiral into despair and kind of a flailing? Or do you grab hold of the anchor of your soul? And do you say, when I am afraid, I put my trust in you? And because Christ has conquered the grave, I too will conquer the grave. And because of Romans 8:28, I trust that this too is working for my ultimate salvation. And because of, and you just start telling yourself true things and true things and true things and true things, such that, and you believe them, and you place your trust in them in that moment. And that will help you to not spiral into fear. So I would say, you know, an initial response to that of fear is not sinful. I'd say it's
pretty natural.
Pretty natural.
Yeah.
What do you do with it is the question.
I think it's the kind of fear that you're seeing all over the place in the Psalms, where the psalmist is in fear of his life.
Yeah.
The question is not, does he feel the fear? The question is, what does he do with it? Does he lean toward the Lord, or does he lean out from the Lord? And of course, the psalmist, by the end of the psalm at least, is always leaning toward the Lord.
Yeah.
So. Can I ask a question that's related to the meditation thing?
Sure.
And actually, it's related to Julia's thing too. What I thought Julia was going to say is, if you're afraid of going to the surgery, is it okay to, like, take a benzo? And you know what I'm talking about, right? Like, I can't.
Is that like one of those calming, you know,
like? Help me out.
They're anxiolytics, so sometimes when somebody's going into the hospital, they'll give you a medication, sort of the pre-anesthesia.
Yes. So for me, I really struggle with, like, dental procedures, and I've gone through a lot of them, like a root canal that's 3 hours long.
Who wouldn't struggle with dental procedures?
I laugh, but I really do. And so they will give me, like, they'll always have to, like, drive me home because I can't drive. But they'll give me one of those. And I don't really see anything wrong with that. I mean, because, like, your body is just, like, having a response of kind of freaking out, and you're just like, oof, that's not wrong, is it?
I don't think so. I think I don't see how getting something that's going to help you calm in the face of a medical. I mean, I'm a little interested in thinking about how do we make sure we don't take that horse and just let it run forever. But the idea that, right? I mean, we go through anesthesia so we don't feel the pain, right? And in a sense, in anticipation of, right? I mean, we're allowed to take drugs to avoid certain sensations that are part of the sin-cursed world. So I don't necessarily have a problem with that. The question is, are you relying on the drug to do the heart? Are you doing that? Are you using the drug to avoid having to do the heart work? There is heart work to be done even in facing a 3-hour root canal. Nothing is not under the.
That's a good word.
Nothing is purely physical and unrelated to God's overall plan to sanctify you. And so there's always, always heart work to be done. Even when I have a headache, there's heart work to be done. I can take ibuprofen, and I do, and I take it quickly. But if I use that as an excuse not to be, so I don't have to, like, this is going to make me not grumpy. No. My heart work I need to engage the gospel in order to sin and love my neighbor as myself and love the Lord my God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength. So if you are facing the root canal, you're asking yourself the question, how do I love the Lord my God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength? Lord, I'm seeking to trust you in this, and I'm going to take a pill. That's you, so don't use medication to avoid doing heart work. Either in that small situation, and that's probably going to be part of my answer to what I'm sure is the question.
Yeah, let's jump off of that into just antidepressants and things like that, because I think that's probably just a very pregnant question in many of your minds. I'll bottom line it up front and then give lots of clarification and we could just talk back.
With the caveat that if you may not find your particular situation specifically addressed in this Q&A, in which case our answer, as it so often is to seek
specific pastoral
counseling.
So just theologically, I do not believe it is sin, black and white sin, to take an antidepressant. I don't believe that's the case.
Anti-anxieties and antidepressants are usually this. Honey, that's usually the same set of medications. So
do I believe that's sinful, carte blanche, period, end of story? No, I do not. I think there can be a place for it. But I think that the danger is we are in a world where we actually, medically and psychologically, we're just trained to actually not deal with our problems, but just dull our pain. Those are so highly overprescribed.
1 in 4 American women.
It's evident to me that we look at it first as our Savior, as our Jesus. I have sometimes been counseling dear brothers or sisters that they're in just such a bad way that I counsel them, actually, I think it would be appropriate for you to go on to a medication for a period of time to kind of get yourself stabilized, steady, and let's begin to work through the sources of what, in fact, has you so down, so anxious, so bound up. Right now you're pinging at level, at 6,500 RPMs, and you just can't think clearly. Let's get you a bit more stable, which those do just bring you down a notch. And then let's begin to work it through. And then, depending on how that goes, the long term, what happens, we'll just see. But I'll just start with that. Do I think that it's carte blanche sin? No, I don't. Also, but if you are considering taking, if you're just in a bad way and you're considering taking antidepressants, boy, I would just tell you that you have done yourself a disservice if you first go to your doctor and don't go to your pastor.
Amen.
You've done yourself such a significant disservice. Brothers and sisters, we live in an age where we think specialists and experts. So we think, if I have a real problem, I need to go to an expert. I just want to tell you, your pastor who knows you and who knows the depth of the human soul is actually more of an expert on your psychology and your emotional state than a doctor. And your pastor who knows you and who knows the depth of the human soul and who knows the Bible and the gospel is more equipped to help you than a professional with a lot of things, behind their name.
With a worldview that is out of sync.
With a worldview that is out of sync with the scriptures and that doesn't understand that behind every emotional reality, intertwined intimately with it, is a heart reality that God is speaking to and that we want to think about. So I'll just tell you, Jim, from personal history, there have been multiple of you, some in this room, and many not, who've come to me and we've talked, and you were just on the verge of an absolute breakdown, and after 5 or 6 sessions, feeling more robust, more strong, more steady, more solid than you've ever felt. And it's not because I'm a genius or Brad's a genius. It's because God's word is sufficient. So I just want to say that. If you're thinking about taking antidepressants, please come and talk to me or please come and talk to Brad. We're not going to tell you some, you know, unnuanced, that's bad, never do that, trust God and pray. You know, what we're going to do is instead say, tell me what's going on. Tell me what's going on. The human heart is complicated. Life is complicated. Life is hard. Life is full of sorrows. What's going on? Let us hear you. Let us pray for you. Let us think with you. Let us talk about what the Bible has to say about these things. Please, please, please don't run to your doctor and get a prescription. You're doing yourself a disservice.
The Bible often is going to say, trust God and pray, but...
Yeah.
I know what you're saying. Yeah, Damon.
So this is possibly more of a niche question, and if you can't answer it, I totally get it, but it's just something that for food for thought.
Niche question.
I thought of it over the course of this emotional series is what about folks who have experienced significant trauma? Post-traumatic stress, and also like traumatic brain injury. A lot of studies show that that has actual physical impact on being able to regulate emotions and thoughts. So what's your pastoral thoughts on that?
I think, battle injuries and the things that you experience in a war scenario are of untold difficulty to the human soul and the human body. And so I think, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome, whatever you want to call it, real. Actually have a great book from a Christian worldview perspective that I'd love to give you or anybody else who's thinking about that. Same thing still holds true, right? We are our makeup, Anthony Hokema, really kind of in his anthropology is the study of humanity, okay? What makes us who we are? How are we? Who and what and how are we? Anthony Hokema, I believe he coined the phrase psychosomatic unity. If he didn't, he certainly popularized it theologically. In other words, we are not just physical and we are not just spiritual. We are spiritual and physical, and those two are absolutely intertwined together, inextricably linked together, such that our spiritual state impacts our physical state, such that our physical state impacts our spiritual state. And so...
And vice versa.
And verse visa. Well, didn't I say verse visa up front?
I'm sure you did.
Okay. So all of this goes together. So again, what it's coming down to is that none of it can be relegated to, well, that's just a biology thing and doesn't have any impact on us spiritually. Or that's just a spiritual thing and doesn't have any impact on me biologically. Well, no. It's all together. And so that's what I would say.
I would say one other thing. I'm thinking about other situations that would have a similar effect, like a physical disability or something like that, or a congenital disability. I'm thinking, and they're not here, I'm thinking of my sister and brother-in-law and how they help Reuben. They understand that Reuben's situation and his cognitive and whole person disorder that has been with him since birth, makes it harder for him to regulate his emotions. They do recognize that that he is responsible before God still for how he conducts himself, and they, knowing his frame, knowing his particular challenges, still work as best they can. They don't say, well, he's not responsible for his emotions and how he expresses them. And so I would say in the same thing.
But they work within his limitations.
Within his limitations.
And
patiently.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, yes. Absolutely. That's an excellent illustration, Brad.
But the idea being, whenever we have an instinct that says something has happened and that minimizes my responsibility, or, well, I won't say minimize. When we say, therefore I don't have the responsibility to govern myself. That is where I think we come into conflict with the scriptures. The scriptures always hold us responsible, while acknowledging that there may be terrible things post-Genesis 3 that make that more challenging. And God knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. As a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. Right? But we actually remain responsible. There's nothing that is going to happen to you in this life that will make you not responsible for your actions and reactions.
That's great.
That's just a that's not in contradiction to anything you said.
Yeah.
So we've talked a lot about like people having fear for things they can't avoid, like a surgery or whatever, but what if someone has like a fear that they can get through life without doing, like flying or heights or, I don't know, like things that they can still avoid? Would you encourage them to do those things? Or
if that's the case, Abby, I would have to go bungee jumping, and I don't plan on going bungee jumping.
If you can go
through life avoiding the thing that you fear, is that legitimate? Is that?
I want to go bungee jumping. Who does? Okay, Amelia, you and me. All right. One thing that might play into an answer there is how much does that restrict you from doing good and sane things? You know, if your fear of flying is such as to where you're not going to get on an airplane,
do something that would be wise and loving.
I'm not going to go to my brother's wedding, you know, in Arizona because it's too far to drive and I'm too scared to fly. I think you need to screw up your courage and get on an airplane,
And get the help
and talk it through ahead of time and, you know, and let's work on this. So it partly depends on how restricted does that make you from doing good and reasonable and even enjoyable things. I think it's enjoyable. Let's say you love to travel. You really do. I mean, you would love seeing other sights, but you're so afraid of flying that you will not. I'd say you're keeping yourself from a tremendous blessing through that fear, and you need to push through that fear.
Yeah, Abby, one huge place this plays out is parenting. Oh. I can do any number of things and make my child's world very small because I'm afraid of them, of the chance, right? I could say, I do not want them riding a bike because they could, or I don't want them sledding because they... and so when we let our fears keep us from doing things that are... We just kind of want to be normal. There is a sense that the gospel makes us weird enough. We do kind of want to be normal. So, you know, so when...
And also, can I just dovetail on that? That increasingly, we are becoming more and more and more fearful. There's a book called The Coddling of the American Mind, written by two secular university guys, not Christians, and they talk about essentially the good intentions and bad ideas that are ruining a generation. And one of the bad ideas that's well-intentioned is what doesn't kill you makes you weaker. And they, even from an evolutionary standpoint, which I reject, but even from an evolutionary standpoint, they argue that what doesn't kill you actually makes you stronger. That humans, both physically and emotionally, are not fragile, we're anti-fragile. What challenges us actually makes us stronger, both in the physical and in the emotional realm. Now, that is what is true, but what is being believed and kind of pushed out is a spirit, really, of fear that keeps us from experiencing anything that might be bad. And what that actually does is it makes us weaker and weaker and weaker and less productive in the world and in our homes and in our churches.
More risk averse, less likely to...
And it's bad. It's not a recipe for human flourishing. It's a recipe for disaster.
And it's creating the anxiety that we're...
And it's actually... It's, it's, yeah, it's... It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It has the effect of creating more anxiety than dispelling it.
Can you flesh that out? Give examples of what specific stuff you're talking about in parenting.
Sure, give an example. The Anxious Generation?
Yeah,
that was on there.
So they were talking about, you know, how dangerous playgrounds used to be, right? They had these really tall climbing structures that kids, like now, parents would say, oh, they could fall off of that and break their arm, you know? And now our play structures are safer, right? They're not as tall, they're not as precarious, there's more... like
there aren't merry-go-rounds on them.
Right, but actually kids learning how to figure out what is dangerous on their own actually helps them be braver in the future, helps them to not be anxious of things that might hurt them, right? And so you're just, by trying to protect them from those dangers, you're helping to grow their anxiety. At least that was my understanding.
I'd love other examples from you guys. If we could redound with examples from you guys for a second, I'd love that. Chris, is that what you'd like to do?
Yeah, I think I recall from that book that you mentioned, Coddling of the American Mind, that, don't quote me on this, but I think, like they were saying, back in the 70s, like a little kid to go to kindergarten, some things that they needed to essentially have done, and some of those things are like, is able to walk home from
school.
Two or three blocks away from school, has done that by themselves, whereas today they're saying, wow, parents just don't have a category for that. Again, just kind of that resiliency and how it's the same example that Nikki gave with the crazy playgrounds to what they are today. It's just how we've really, you know, tried to do the good thing, but at the end of the day, haven't resulted in a good thing.
Amy, and then I saw another hand over here.
I can give an example of that. So those dangerous playgrounds can still be found in Latin America.
Yeah.
Kids did them. And I remember we were living in Bolivia. My kids were playing on those, like, crazy tall slide, no protection. You could also probably get tetanus from it. And we came back to the D.C. area for the summer, and we were in the D.C. area at the Reston Town Center, kind of fancy shopping outdoor area, and they had a fountain. And they had a, like, 2-foot wall, maybe. And Matthew was probably 3 or 4. And he was walking along, and it was probably this wide, you know, that he was walking along. And I was walking with him, not up on the platform, the 2-foot platform, but beside him. And a police officer came over to me.
A police
and
officer?
Made me feel like the worst mother ever for allowing my son to walk on this 2-foot high platform. I mean, like, I was almost in tears. He made me feel like I was the worst mother ever. And we had just had, you know, we had just come from Bolivia. Anything goes. So that was a very vivid thing in my mind. And I'm a cautious person. Like, I'm, you know, I have to catch myself, or had to with my kids, like, allowing them to do more than I was comfortable with. So.
Was there another? Sonia, did you have some?
Yeah. Well, two things. So the Brisky playground is actually coming back. They did research that exactly what you guys are saying, that kids need to be able to know the limits and stuff. And, like, at our school, kids are not allowed to run at recess. I'm not even kidding.
Kids are not allowed to run at recess.
They could run into each other. So there's other things like that in the South, but they're doing this thing called Risky Recess, where they're letting the kids run. They're letting them do things that, and there's, like, almost, like, no rules. And the teachers are not intervening. Like, when the kids kind of, they're letting them, like, work stuff out on their own. People are falling off things, and you know what? They're okay. So I think that's a good thing. But then also I was going to say, I don't feel like I'm that cautious of a mom. My kids recently were jumping off the garage roof onto a trampoline. I feel good about it. And I'm like, I always felt like my mom was...
There's
like,
freedom, different thoughts on this, people.
But, like, you know, my kids are having peace, and my mom... like, what if they fall and break their arm? Elisa knows that. And I'm like, then they break their arm. It's like a rite of passage, you know? But I definitely say, like,
you know, we live on a busy road, and my kids want to bike on this busy road without a helmet. And so, like, there are things that you do that are not, like, out of fear. You know,
sure,
like, I'm going to
sure.
put a helmet on my kid. I'm going to
sure.
put them in a car seat. You know, I'm going to do these things that are right to do, and
that's
I don't think
that's
there.
The use that Rain God gave you.
Yeah. I think I would just encourage us all as Christians, let's be, I think it's good to recognize this, but also I would ask you to like, just kind of do some hard work to see, is this going on, especially like you young moms? Let me just speak a pastoral word to you. You young moms, trust me, it's going to be really tempting for you to just super overprotect. Like I just encourage moms, as soon as I see you bringing your babies to church, I just praise you. Way to go. Way to bring them, and then let everybody hold them, okay? Let everybody hold them. They don't have to be with you all the time. You're not the
get
only...
Get a babysitter and have a date night with
you're
your
not
husband.
The only sane person who knows how to hold a baby so that their neck isn't snapped. You know, people know how to do that. Trust other people with your children. Trust them in the nursery. Get a babysitter and go on a date. They don't need you. If you think they do... If you think they do, you're just wrong. So they can get along without you, and actually what's needed is for you to get along without them. It's for them to not become the center of your world. Okay. So that's just one way you can find. I'm just saying let's try to bring this into us and see, are there ways in which we are, you know, being maybe too overprotective, right? Let's not be too overprotective with our children. We don't want to do that out of fear.
Note to self, there are parenting cohorts that are going to be going on this summer.
Oh, yes, please. There are. Let me just give you a heads up.
PSA.
We are doing a... Can we just move to the mic for him? So his microphone is demon-possessed. And so... okay, Mike, we're moving to this for Brad. So there is a parenting... There are parenting classes that are going to be taking place this summer called Parenting with Confidence. And it's elders and their wives, and they're inviting smaller groups of you younger parents into their homes. Each group is going to be between 6 to 7 couples, and then also some youngers who don't have kids yet, but we think might be having kids sometime in the future. We're going to invite you too. You're going to be getting a call from one of the elder couples. There's 3 elder couples. They're going to be having these in their homes. It's a 7-week series where you're going to watch some videos and then discuss and dialogue as a small group in these elders' homes. So I just want to invite you to be looking for that, participate in that, parenting with confidence. It's going to be awesome. Boy, I don't know what to, I don't even know what to do.
Chris has been waiting for a while.
Chris has been waiting for a while? Who?
Yeah, just Chris.
Okay.
I was just wondering, because you talk about, you know, letting your kid walk to school. And when I was little, our school was literally right up the street. I guess when David was young, we didn't let him walk around alone. I guess the thought was just, you know, I don't think people stole kids maybe anymore when he was little than when I was little. I don't know. But I was really concerned about if he, I didn't mind, like, in church he's running around, but if he was just sort of walking, you know, when he was little, I mean. What do you think about that? Do you think that's being overprotective?
I don't know. I think every parent's going to kind of have their own, they're going to calibrate themselves differently on that.
Just shifted.
Pardon?
The windows just shifted.
Yeah. I do think, so in The Coddling of the American Mind, they actually chronicle... in the 80s and 90s, a specific campaign that was waged significantly over all public media that just emphasized strongly, how risky it was to have your kids go out. People are going to steal them. And then they just documented, it's just statistically not true. It's become safer and safer and safer. People don't snatch up kids, statistically speaking, a lot. It does happen. But it doesn't happen a lot, statistically speaking. But parents are going to calibrate themselves differently on that. I just think, kind of make your own call there.
Alisa?
I do think it's worth saying, the more as parents we are anxious about things, just realize that actually gets passed on
Ooh.
To the children.
That's so, fire, Alisa.
Yes.
Well, your anxieties will transfer to your children.
Yes.
Your anxieties will be learned by your children, and they will.
Them, but what are you, you know, what's going on in being modeled at home also?
Boy, a lot. Boy, just a lot. Have mercy. I don't know. I don't even know what to do. Brad, take over.
Amelia, then Johnny.
I have a question. So what if you are, someone is coming to you often with their anxiety and fear, and it is sinful anxiety and fear, and they're not willing to see it as sin, and so they're constantly coming to you, but it just seems like they're coming to you for affection, and they're not willing to actually get help?
I have not dealt with that very often. I would think that I would probably try to just open up more fundamental gospel realities, and try to talk about the gospel, and try to talk about the gospel more. And do we really understand the gospel? Are we really trusting in the gospel? Are we really trusting in a good and sovereign God? I don't know if I have too much wisdom on that.
You're trying to get them. But at the end of the day, if they are unwilling to see something as a matter of the heart, there will be a certain limit to how much I think that they will see progress. So you're trying to kind of say, but is that, does that square with what the Bible say? Johnny.
Discussion has kind of painted a picture for me that there's a line between overprotectionism and parental wisdom. And so kind of tied to that, what would your advice be in a situation where your children are within a circle of significant bullying, and I have some fears about how that will affect their view of themselves and how they grow up and how they interact with other people? It certainly creates a lot of opportunity for me to talk about who they are in Christ and their identity from a biblical sense. But how much of that is like, actually, I want you to go out there and experience that, because that is the reality of the world. There will be people that will not be kind to you throughout your whole life. And actually, I want to protect you from that, because I feel like you are too young to experience that.
Yeah, this doesn't negate our responsibility as parents that our fundamental job is to protect them. It is that doesn't change. And what we're saying doesn't actually mean that we're undoing that. Yeah, we are to protect and provide for our children, and fathers especially have that responsibility. And so you're trying to balance, I think. I don't think every situation is going to be absolutely black and white clear, but you're trying to say, okay, I understand that just because my kid got called one name, you know, doesn't mean that I'm going to pull them from whatever activity that they're doing. But if I have a situation where I'm really watching my kid run down, I think most parents are going to take action, and I think that's appropriate. You know, you're either going to seek to address it with whoever's running the thing, or you're going to
or with
say,
the kid's parents if it's an interpersonal relationship.
Or say, you know what, I think this isn't for us. So I don't think that necessarily, yes, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, but that doesn't negate our fundamental need to protect our children, and that fundamental need to protect their children doesn't negate the principle that facing challenging situations does help them grow. So
yeah,
it's going to be a wisdom.
Both true.
Yeah, generate.
So I guess I just have a question kind of about where thinking prudently about things, like we have had kind of the policy that our kids will not participate in sleepovers with like their friends. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they're like church friends. But, you know, I think that like child molestation, I don't think it's necessarily increased. I think it's become just more at like the forefront. So we have more knowledge on that. So like, you know, I went to plenty of sleepovers. I mean, a lot of bad things happen, not necessarily things like that, but, you know, it also there were things that did shape me and help me to grow. So how do we kind of draw that line between being prudent and protective, but also being like, well, you know, they do need to experience some of these things, and just as far as like other people, particularly men, having access to our kids in, you know, maybe an overnight situation with friends outside of the church.
Boy, that's...
We just don't do this.
I think you can. I think that's certainly. I think that's going to be a matter for each mom and dad to decide themselves. What I want to do is the one thing I want to address is just we don't want to be. The culture is very ready to see men as dangerous in a way that we need to protect access from children. Sorry, how am I saying this? We need to protect children from men. And that's absolutely not true. We need to protect children from dangerous men. And so we need to actually kind of make sure that our children are getting regular input from godly men. Yes, because we're seeking to. So I just am saying, in the culture, men bad, right? That's not where we want to be in the church, where God has given leadership to men and the wisdom of the aged, right? We want our kids having lots of good men speak into their lives. But with that said, I think you're just trying to calibrate your own things. To someone who said, I'm not going to have my kids participate in sleepovers, is not necessarily giving into sinful fear.
Yeah, our family didn't do that with people outside church, and we actually didn't even really do it with people inside church. So just the sleepover thing. Until the kids got older, and we just didn't really do that.
Were you just afraid that they were going to get...
I just don't know what happens at 2 a.m. when I'm not there and when kids aren't being supervised by parents. I just don't know what happens. And I just decided to restrict that. I just decided to restrict that. So... not just the men. Yeah, it wasn't. Yeah, you have devices and kids who are like, yeah. We didn't give our kids devices until they were like eighth grade, ninth grade. Even that, I think, is kind of young. Actually, Naomi, Lord love her, she didn't get a. She was a freshman in high school. Was like, you're getting a phone with a keyboard. She's like, I'm the only one. And I'm like, yeah. Anywho, but I'm just saying, kids have access to everything. Kids have access to everything. I don't know what they're going to look at 2 o'clock in the morning when their buddy wakes up and says, hey, look at this. So I just decided to restrict that. That was our decision, Chris and I together.
We have one more question. John.
Oh, sorry. So fear, aside from things like the bear attack, which is instinctual, I think, most fear we learn from other people, and consequently we could choose to unlearn that if we want to?
I don't know if I would say most fear we learn from other people. I would say that we are in a Genesis 3 world where fearful things actually do happen, and so therefore it's not unnatural to have a response of fear, and it's not necessarily learned from others. It's that we actually do live in a dangerous world, but yet we also know God is sovereign, and he cares for his children, and so we want to use the brains that we're given, wisdom. That's the Proverbs. If you just want to grow in wisdom, like, you know, not falling off the donkey on either side of things, you know, no control over your children, do whatever you want, or too much control over your children, right? I'm only going to allow you to eat, you know, this, you know, whatever.
No Twinkies.
What now?
No Twinkies.
No Twinkies. No McDonald's. People, let your kids have those fries. There's none better. So you could fall off the donkey on either side, right? If you want to grow in thinking wisely, read the Proverbs. Just read a proverb a day. That helps you grow in wisdom. But I just think we do live in a dangerous world, but God is sovereign. So we need to use wisdom, but we also need to trust him, and we don't want to be controlled by fear.
Yeah, mistrust of God is what's at issue. We have to trust God's ways, trust his character, trust his heart. And so for book recommendations, Trust in God by, help me, Jerry Bridges. Ed Welch, Running Scared, excellent book.
Spiritual Depression by Lloyd-Jones.
Yeah, that we're going to get into, especially in the last one. Spiritual Depression by Lloyd-Jones. Those would be some of the top three.
We are out of time. Amy, you can come talk to us afterwards. Hey, love you guys. Appreciate you guys. And come and talk to us if you want more. If you want to talk more about these things. We're glad to have those questions. Lord, thank you. Bless us. In Jesus' name, amen.